This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, so let's jump right into the week in review, starting with more trouble at City Hall. This week, federal authorities arrested a second member of Marty Walsh's administration on charges of union-related extortion. The mayor was quick to respond.
If these allegations are true, simply really disheartening, and concerns me.
Tim Sullivan, the city's chief of staff of intergovernmental relations, is charged with threatening to withhold city permits from the Boston Calling Music Festival unless the festival producers hired union stagehands. Sullivan's lawyer, William Santolo, lashed back at the U.S. Attorney's Office, saying a major ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court this week found that routine politician courtesies are not corruption.
When you read the opinion, and then when you read the indictment, I suspect that you will be as convinced as I am, and as convinced as everybody else who has seen this case, this is a crap piece of case.
Still, many are wondering how this new corruption case will affect Mayor Walsh. The mayor's known Sullivan for years. Thomas Farragher, columnist for the Boston Globe, says it's time for Walsh to hit the reset button.
If I were him, I would bring in a whole new crew of people who are a little more seasoned. I think he needs an adult in the room. I think he needs to reach out in more vigorous ways to business leaders, neighborhood advocates.
Well, joining us to discuss this story and the rest of the week's news is Dante Ramos, op-ed columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to have you back, Dante.
Great to be here.
And thanks for being here on the start of the 4th of July weekend. Charlie Chipio joins us as well. He's a research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and head of Chipio Strategies. Great to see you as well, Charlie.
Thank you. Good
and
to be here.
Happy early 4th of July to you as well. So let's start with this second charge of corruption and extortion to a member of Mayor Walsh's administration. Dante, your first thoughts the impact of this story?
I think this story deepens some of the questions that have been out there about Mayor Walsh. He's a former labor leader, and since the beginning of his candidacy for mayor, really, this question has been on the table of whether labor will exercise an outsized influence over his administration. And, you know, he's taken pains rhetorically to say that that's not so. This case, obviously, the second arrest in this Boston Calling situation, suggests that, either the word is on the street or the word was on the street within the administration that this is something that, was a priority of the administration to get more jobs for labor groups, or it's something that, if the mayor wasn't putting that policy out officially, then somebody decided that it was, and that, perhaps the mayor isn't really influencing the policy as strongly as he should be. It's one or the other, and neither is particularly flattering.
I was just going to say neither so good. Charlie, your thoughts?
Well, I'm just shocked that there would be any union strong arming going on in Boston, but
allegedly,
that's right. But what I think this comes down to is a couple of things. One is, Boston and Massachusetts are unusual. This is not the way it is in the rest of the country, but the reality is that we live in a place where, 18 out of the 20 political action committees that give the most to candidates are labor organizations. I mean, labor's power is outsized here, and Boston is the epicenter of that power. And anytime you're in a situation like that, there is certainly a greater chance for corruption or for going a little bit too far. Now, that said, I think the question, there is an open question as to whether this is unseemly or if it's criminal.
Right.
And that's a very different thing. And, we're going to have to wait and see if it rises to that level.
Legally, that's the heart of the case,
right.
Isn't it? I mean, Dante, I see you.
Well, I was going to respond. I think there's a couple different strands here. In terms of whether it's illegal, if the administration had a written policy saying that we'll give permits and 50% of the jobs on those things will be union jobs, that is, that would arguably be a policy. Whether that's legal or not could be tested in court. If it happens behind the scenes, it does. If that did happen, it is kind of strong arming in one way or another. So, I don't think it's exactly just a pro-labor mayor or pro-labor administration having a pro-labor policy. The other part I wanted to respond to was the suggestion from the lawyer for Mr. Sullivan that the Supreme Court decision somehow, somehow would make this prosecution irrelevant.
Hold that thought, Dante, because I want to hear what you have to say, but I want to play a little bit more from William Santolo on exactly this point, because he went into when when he spoke in front of federal court this week, he went into some very specific detail about that case. Okay, so this was the case that the high court decided this week regarding former Virginia Governor Bob McDonald, who had faced a conviction for doing political favors for businessmen who had given the governor money and in gifts and loans in exchange for some kind of access. But his conviction, McDonald's conviction, was overturned by the Supreme Court. Now, Sullivan's lawyer here in Boston, William Santolo, really went to great pains to reference that case. So here's more tape.
The Supreme Court specifically said setting up meetings of this nature are not only not criminal, but they would chill any politician's effect of doing his job. The day after that decision was rendered by the United States Supreme Court, this office indicted my client. So I'm hoping that they read that decision. I'm expecting that this court will give the Supreme Court a little bit more respect than the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Okay, Dante, your thoughts.
I think that's an impressive bit of table pounding by that particular attorney. The defendants in this case are not being accused of setting up meetings. They're being accused of withholding permits for a legal enterprise. And
or as the reporters tried to ask, did they strong arm?
Right.
Santolo doesn't answer.
So that's an official act. Withholding permits is an official act. You know, the Virginia case was a little bit curious, where it was clear that the governor took a lot of money that he probably shouldn't have taken. What was less clear was what precisely he did for the other, for the other parties. It's actually, in this case, it's almost the exact opposite. It's pretty clear what the people are being accused of. It is an official act.
Yeah. So, Charlie, I want to turn back to something that you said a little earlier, and that was you mentioned that the number of
the political action committees.
Political action committees that are supported by labor in Boston. I mean, are you implying there that just that fact alone should make people look askance? I mean, wouldn't that be true for any political action committee, regardless of who they're supported by?
I think that sometimes there is a number or a little factoid that really tells you a whole lot about area politics. And certainly, whatever you feel about labor, I really am not anti-labor. I just think that I am troubled by any organization that gains the level of power that they have here. And I just think that when you have, 18 out of 20 of the political action committees that give the most money in Massachusetts being labor organizations, then it sort of tells you who wields the power here. And again, I think that this is certainly not the case nationally. I think it's a very different picture. But I think that they wield power here in what is a one-party state that is that reaches a level that is it is not healthy for any organization or any entity or any interest group to have the level of power that they have here.
You know, but on the other hand, when we talked about this on our show earlier this week, we were thinking about how that fact that you mentioned about the number of PACs in Massachusetts was the same when Mayor Menino was mayor of Boston for 20 years, right? And yet there was nothing. I mean, his administration was squeaky clean.
Right. No, absolutely. And I don't think it means that, every politician as a result, is doing bad things. But I think that it does mean that you get a situation where you have sort of the confluence of a guy who has a very strong labor background becoming the mayor, that we have things like, I think what most people around the country would say is sort of a crazy anti-privatization law. You know, there are these sort of ways in which it shows itself in the way that our politics are run here.
Dante?
I just wanted to underscore, Meghna, the point that you just made a minute ago about the contrast between, the Menino administration and the current administration. One of the barriers that Walsh faces here is the realization that most people have that, there was 20 years where this kind of scandal wasn't, where you didn't hear about this kind of thing. And at the least, Tom Menino was someone who had a very firm hand over his own administration and a lot of other things in the city, for better or for worse. And I think it obviously in the minds of the public will raise questions at the least about, the extent to which Mayor Walsh is in control of his own situation.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's turn now to another major story this week, and that's the latest chapter in the tumult, the serious tumult at Boston Latin School. It's been buffeted by controversy since allegations back in January by two students of multiple racial incidents at the school. Last week, the school's headmaster, Lynn Mooney Tata, and assistant headmaster, Malcolm Flynn, announced their resignations. And this week, Superintendent Tommy Chang named Michael Contempassis to be interim headmaster. Contempassis has actually been in that post before. He was headmaster for 22 years at Boston Latin from 1976 to 1998. So first of all, Charlie, let me just get your quick thoughts on this naming of Michael Contempassis as interim headmaster at Latin.
Well, I have to say that it's making me feel kind of old because back in the dark ages when I worked in college admissions here at BU, we went over to in the 80s to Boston Latin and met with Michael Contempassis, and now he's back there. But I have to say that I'm biased. I know Michael Contempassis a little bit, and I really think very highly of him. And I think that clearly these sort of racial incidents are not, there has to be, zero tolerance for that kind of thing. And I think he is the kind of guy who will take charge and won't let that happen. And I, to be honest with you, in what is a highly political world, I also like the idea that he's interim. He's not looking for his next job, and he just has going to have the freedom to do whatever he thinks is right during his tenure there. So I think he is a good selection.
And one thing that Boston Latin parents have been telling me is that the school right now, more than anything, needs some stability, which hopefully he can bring. But Dante, your thoughts?
I would agree. I think Contempassis is a, he's an old pro. He's been in the school system for a long time and, provides a certain level of stability. I will say that the current tension at Boston Latin is the latest outgrowth of a dynamic that has existed for many years at that school, and frankly, is present in a lot of urban school districts around the country where there is a majority-minority population among the school children, and yet there's a magnet school where that attracts people from across the city, typically at the high school level. You see it in a lot of other cities that attracts a disproportionately white population. And I don't know that – I think there's a lot of school districts that struggle with how to – how to approach this in an equitable manner, because you have the most visible public school in the city being seen in some quarters as a symbol of inequality by, certain members of certain minority communities. And it's been something that's very destructive to harmony in a lot of school districts.
Right.
And there's a lot of difference from city to city in terms of how that's dealt with. Some cities just have a straight, sort of test-based who gets in that's entirely blind. Other states or other cities don't and have more of a sliding scale. So there are a whole lot of issues involved with that.
Well, even at Boston Latin back in the day, decades ago, they didn't even have the exam, right?
But right.
And then they introduced an exam, and then there were two court cases. And then at one point in time, they had what they were calling set-asides for students of color in terms of admissions, and those were knocked down by two federal court cases. And so the school itself has tried multiple ways of dealing with, as Dante, as you said, this long-running question of who makes up the student body there. I mean, to me, it's like sometimes it's hard to really sort of tease out all the different parts of this story, because there's the immediate need of addressing what the culture is at Boston Latin. Because I think when so many young people come forward and say, we've been made to feel uncomfortable, there's an issue there that needs to be looked at.
Yep.
Then there's also that broader issue of, okay, well, if Boston is going to do a better job, if the district is going to do a better job of preparing young students of color in the district as a whole who want to take the exam and go to Boston Latin, how should it do that? Is it doing it in the right way? Are they doing enough outreach, enough prep? I mean, sometimes I think these two things are getting sort of smashed together in the public conversation about what's happening.
You know, it's the sometimes conflicting, certainly not always, but sometimes conflicting sort of values of excellence and equity. And, sort of sorting that out and threading the needle is an awfully hard thing to do.
I would just add on, I think there are a couple of other dynamics that are making this situation particularly delicate. First of all, you have a new superintendent who's from Los Angeles and so, is kind of gradually getting the feel of how of the dynamics in the Boston school system, but doesn't at this point necessarily have a firm command of who all the groups are. I think there's also It's kind of a delicate political moment for the Walsh administration. You know, I think the previous segment illustrated that. But, you know, I think conventional wisdom in political circles is that Walsh, who enjoyed significant support from Black and Latino voters in his last election, you know, is looking over his shoulder for, you know, in case there are challengers within the Black or Latino communities, and that this is something that is a test of his ability to handle a potentially very divisive issue. And so I think the stakes are actually quite high.
Yeah, especially given that Tito Jackson, who could be that challenger, is also, I think he's the chair of the Council's Education Committee. He's been very involved in this issue, and you know, a year from now, we'll be in the midst of a mayoral campaign.
Well, and obviously the question of what to do with regarding Boston schools and specifically Latin is going to go on, and we'll keep covering that. But let's plow ahead here to another story from this week. And that has to do with the Senate's bill on ride-hailing companies. Because on Wednesday, the state Senate passed a bill, 34-2, that would require ride-hailing companies like Uber or Lyft to provide driver information to the state for a background check. That bill, however, has to be reconciled with the House version, which was passed back in March. And just a little bit more background here. Both versions would regulate ride-hailing companies under the Department of Public Utilities. The House, though, requires an additional state-conducted background check for drivers. So your thoughts, Dante. Let's start with you.
There's a big difference between the House bill and the Senate bill on this. The House bill made an honest effort, and we can talk about whether it's, you know, it'll be an effective effort or not, but made an honest effort to split the difference between the interests of the ride-hailing companies and the incumbent taxi industry. And so there were some provisions in the House bill that would, you know, protect taxi companies in various ways. The Senate bill basically said, look, yeah, that's kind of a lost battle, and we'll, you know, we'll try to regulate the ride-hailing companies in a more kind of modern, more efficient manner, and didn't really leave a whole lot of the measures that the ride-hailing taxi industry had wanted. You know, the taxi industry basically wants to make things maximally difficult for Uber and Lyft, and that's why they, along with the police chiefs, have been pushing this fingerprinting issue. I mean, my own opinion is that the fingerprinting doesn't really contribute a ton to public safety, and Boston didn't start, you know, after 100 years of having cabs, didn't start fingerprinting drivers literally until a few months ago. So that issue is a little bit of a red herring from my point of view, but it does speak to, you know, how much the bill is tilted towards the taxi industry or the ride-hailing companies.
I mean, I take your point about why you would see it as a red herring, but I think there are people, maybe even beyond the taxi industry itself, who do say that, you know, yes, the technology is changing how we live, but that doesn't mean that we should do, we should get relaxed about things like public safety. Charlie?
Well, I tell you, I really prefer the Senate bill. I think that the House bill comes out as sort of government putting their thumb on the scales in a way that I just don't think it is helpful. I mean, you know, for example, the House saying, well, these ride-hailing vehicles can't go to the convention center or can't go to Logan or you know, and creating this, pulling this money out of this, some economic development fund and sort of giving it to these wealthy cab medallion owners to try to prop them up because the reality is that they're having trouble competing. You know, I just think that this is a classic kind of economic disruptor, and either the taxi industry is going to learn how to improve and be able to compete with it, or they're going to kind of go the way of the typewriter. And I think that on balance, that's never smooth, but I think on balance, you know, that's a good thing for consumers.
Well, let's play a couple pieces of tape here from some folks we talked to this week about it. Chris Taylor, we spoke to him. He's the Boston General Manager for Uber, and he spoke to us earlier this week about how he says that he favors that companies themselves do the background checks rather than drivers having to report to a state department for a state-conducted check. And in the clip you're about to hear, he talks about folks and their CORI records. That's the criminal offender record information. So here's Chris Taylor.
The safety outcome is going to be the same. We want that CORI check done. We're supportive of that. But we'd love to have it be more convenient for drivers so that they don't have to jump through hoops unnecessarily.
And State Senator Linda Dorsina-Fori advocated for fingerprinting, Dante, that red herring of yours, in addition to background checks on the Senate floor. Here she is.
Well, we know TNC is a part of the infrastructure here in the Commonwealth, part of the transportation economy and the mode for people to get around. We are not trying to kill TNCs. We are trying to be fair.
She talks about TNCs, which are transportation network companies. So, Dante, let me just quickly ask you about something that that Charlie said and was sort of echoed in that piece of tape from Senator Dorsina Forey about, you know, how much should government be involved when it comes to the emergence of these new really sort of life-changing technologies or ways of living or parts of our economy. I mean, she says it right there. We're not trying to kill them. We're trying to be fair. Does the government have any role in this at all?
This does. One of the reasons it's such an interesting debate to watch is it's a much more libertarian type of discussion than we're used to watching here in Massachusetts. I think there is a kind of there's a certain level of uncertainty about what role the government should play. The prevailing view 100 years ago about taxis was that, yeah, you needed a lot of government oversight to provide a safe ride to people. Now the theory that's being put out by the ride-hailing companies, and I have to say I tend to agree with it, is that there are other means of achieving that other than having, you know, having you go down to the precinct and get fingerprinted.
Hmm. Well, Charlie, last thought?
Yeah, no, I agree, you know, that whole argument's going to change when President Johnson and Vice President Weld take over. Oh,
well, on that note, let's save a little bit of time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe weren't top of mind this week, but deserve a fair shake anyway. So, Dante, what's your hubbub?
Well, my hubbub is about the zillions of germs in the MBTA. If you're riding the MBTA home this afternoon, despite what I just said, relax. According to a study released this week by Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, the microbes lurking in Boston's public transportation system are no more harmful than anything that you would encounter from a handshake. For 3 days, researchers from Harvard traveled through the T network, swabbing basically every surface they could find. And okay, the straps on the subway cars were a little bit dodgy, as were the fabric seats. But the metal poles, as it turns out, were relatively clean because germs can't stick to them. Last year, another group of researchers had claimed that New York subway had traces of bubonic plague and anthrax, but not the tea. You know, not infected with anthrax may be a low standard, but in these uncertain times, you take what you can get.
So I have two responses to that. One is, you know, just as safe as a handshake, a lot of people out there are going, ew, handshakes, right? And second, when my second kid was born and was very tiny, I actually took him on the tee one day, and this woman came up to me and first of all looked at me like I was committing an act of child abuse. But she said, you're a very brave mother. So to that lady, yes, Dante's story does affirm that I was being brave,
right.
Maybe not so brave.
But. Well, I would also add that, you know, all those people who are waiting to get over the Sagamore Bridge right now, it could be worse. At least they're not on the tea with the bubonic plague.
No bubonic plague on the tea.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. New York. Yes, you're right.
Charlie, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub this week is about the need to save the Citgo sign.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was great news this week. As you may know, BU is going to sell the building, apparently, that the Citgo sign sits atop. And there is an effort afoot for the Boston Landmarks Commission to take up a measure to actually recall the Citgo sign a landmark, so that if that happens, they would have to go through this commission if they were to make any change to the sign, as one of millions of generations of drunken BU students who found their way back over the years, thanks to being able to look up and see the Citgo sign. Even though if you're on Storrow Drive and it twists and turns, after a while you're starting to think that maybe you're hallucinating because it's there and it's there. But nonetheless, the Citgo sign, I think, needs to be a permanent landmark here in Boston, and I applaud the efforts to save it.
I agree. It's one of those things that I could always look for on the horizon, and I feel like I know exactly where I am, depending on where the Citgo sign
is. It's also a beacon to Boston Marathon runners.
Yes.
One more
you're
mile.
You're almost there, exactly.
That's right.
Well, so my hubbub falls under the category of a good business person knows how to make lemonade out of lemons, or in this case, some money off of, I don't know if I can call it rotten apples, because the Boston Beer Company is seeking to put a trademark on the word Brexit for a new hard cider that the makers of Sam Adams are trying to create. So great little opportunity there. However, I would note that I'm very close to someone who's from the southwestern part of England that makes a lot of cider. And he points out that not every county in southwestern England did vote to leave the EU. So he wanted me to tell the folks at Sam Adams, you cannot use a cider a recipe that comes from Exeter because they voted to stay. All right. Brexit trademarking attempts by
Boston
Beer
Company.
That's
why Coke is a billionaire and we're not. He thinks of those kind of things.
Jim Cook.
Right. That's right.
That's Celsius. Right.
The Cokes are billionaires too.
Yeah, they're billionaires too. That's
right. And the three of us are still not. So.
Yes.
Charlie Chipio, research fellow at the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at the Harvard Kennedy School and head of Chipio Strategies. Always great to have you. Thank you so much. And Dante Ramos, columnist for the op-ed page of the Boston Globe. Great to have you and happy 4th of July weekend to
you
both
too.
Of you.
Happy 4th to you and everyone.
Yes.
We'll be back. This is Radio Boston.